let's take a look at our outline. We're gonna cruise here a little bit till we can get to where I need to be. We're talking about the conquest today. Our time frame is 1406 to 1050 BC. You can see that clearly on your outline. 1050 BC is the beginning of the United Kingdom of Israel, and the time where Israel, starting in 1050, will have three kings that will rule the United Kingdom. And I'll save that for next week. What we're going to talk about today is, remember we were in the book of Deuteronomy when I ran out of time last time, and we're sitting on the Jordanian side of the Jordan River, and we were with Joshua, Caleb, all those guys. Moses is not going to be making the trip across, and I said, oh, we need to talk about a couple other things in Deuteronomy before we go. So we're going to take care of a little Deuteronomy business, and then we're going to head right on in. Book review, this is a tough book to get a hold of, but if you can get a hold of this book, it's really worth it. It's called An Outline of Hebrew History. Payne is the author. This book was written in 1954. If you're really into chronology of the Old Testament and understanding more about culture of the Old Testament, this book is a treasure. Now, the only place you can get on Amazon, you could, you know, they have the used book department. You can just type the book in and say you want to buy it, and there are several used book dealers that may have a copy of it, but we don't have a copy of it in our bookstore. But it's such an awesome book, I wanted to at least recommend it to you. Now, look at our Roman numeral 2. I just want to continually give you the dates. So we have dates that we're looking at. Moses, born 1527. We think he died in 1406 BC. We see Exodus and the law given in 1446. The tabernacle set up in 1445. Israel entering into the land in 1406. We see Joshua's birth date, as best we can get it, 1505, and dies in 1395. Inside the book of Joshua in 1400 approximately B.C., Joshua is going to divide the land to the 12 tribes. And I wanted to bring up a couple of guys that we're going to be seeing right around the corner here in the class. One of them is Judge Samuel, not Judge Judy, but Judge Samuel, a whole different character. And he was a judge from 1070 to 1050 B.C. And then you'll see the reign of a guy named Saul, 1050 to 110 BC. So a little bit of forward and futuristic thinking for us. Let's take care of the business in Deuteronomy. Remember Deuteronomy in Hebrew? Hebrew Bible is not called Deuteronomy. It's called what? It's right there on the outline. These are the words. Deuteronomy, two words, right? We talked about that in Greek. Deuter, second, nomos, nami, the law, the second teaching of the law, the same law from Exodus, but to the next generation of people. Just looking through your outline just quickly, the essence of God's law is found in Deuteronomy 10, verses 12 through 13. If you had a theme verse for the book of Deuteronomy, here it is. And it says, "And now, Israel, what does Yahweh, your God, require of you? But to fear Yahweh, your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve Yahweh, your God, with all your heart, and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments, and statutes of the Lord, which I'm commanding you today for your good." Now, I told you it's kind of a funny name as to the way the book of Deuteronomy is written and put together. And here's the funny name. Can you see it on your outline? There's a funny name. The book of Deuteronomy is presented in what's called the Caesarean vassal treaty form. And basically what that is a king to a subject, a king to a subject. So when we look at Deuteronomy, if you go back at it, you see there's a preamble to a covenant. You see that in chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. And then there are people that are involved in this covenant. The parties involved are God and Israel, right? God and Israel. Who's the mediator? Moses. Moses becomes the mediator. The witnesses to this big covenant become the heavens and the earth. They're the witnesses to it. Then next is the historical prologue to the covenant. That takes you from chapter 1, verse 6, all the way to chapter 3, verse 29. And here is a review of the past relationship between the parties. And they emphasize benevolence to the king to encourage faithful people. So if you know the book of Deuteronomy, you know these chapters are all about what happened in the wilderness. And how did these parties get along before? God and Israel, what happened? And we see that God is always a benevolent God. He's always a gracious God to these people. Even his punishment, he is going to provide a remnant to keep the promises that he made, his land promises and his spiritual promises to a guy named Abraham, because that contract was unconditional, unilateral, doesn't depend upon the people doing anything at all. Now, item three are the stipulations of the covenant. And the stipulations of this covenant are found in chapters 4 through 26. And it binds the obligations of the people to the king. Chapter 28 teaches that Yahweh will bless obedience and he will punish disobedience. Blessings and punishments. Blessings and curses. Blessings are victories over enemies. Victories over enemies. Prosperity in everyday life and prominence among all the nations. And Israel, if they obey, man, they're going to get everything they want. It's going to be a good thing. They'll beat their enemies up. They'll prosper financially. They'll prosper spiritually. But if they don't, punishments are defeat and oppression by the enemies, ruin and frustration in everyday life, and exile in some cases to unknown lands. Now, that idea of punishment and blessings, if you think it through a little bit, is that really something that the New Testament teaches? If you and I obey God, are we going to win every battle? If we obey God, are we going to have financial prosperity? And we have to be discerning here. People ask about the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And here clearly, these types of blessings for obedience, and I wrote it all in capital letters, this is not a New Testament concept. It's not really a New Testament concept. There's truth that God will bless us for obedience, but it won't necessarily give you more money. It won't necessarily make sure you win every victory against every adversary that you have out there. But the promises that are made in Deuteronomy are just that. And that's why this contract, this covenant, if you go back and read Deuteronomy and look at the way I've outlined it, you'll see that this is an agreement between a great king and a group called his subjects. So take a look at Roman numeral 4. There's our Old Testament timeline. These dates are approximate. Don't throw anything about me telling me, are you saying that the earth was created in 3000 BC? I'm not saying that, okay? We're not here to put an exact date on the creation story, but Genesis approximately takes place, let's say, in 3000 BC to 1805 BC. Why 1805? What happens in 1805 BC? Anyone? Did you say the death of Joseph? Okay, that gives us a pretty good timeline. That's very good. And then Exodus. We see the birth of Moses all the way to the conquest, or I'm sorry, to the giving of the law, rather, 1445. Then Leviticus, more of the Levitical training, offerings, that happens in approximately 1445 B.C. Numbers, 1446 to 1406, approximately the 40 years of wandering. Deuteronomy, 1406. Joshua, we're going to find out, 1406 to 1395. 11 years of history in the book of Joshua. And then we're going to know that the book of Judges approximately takes us from 1395 to 1070 B.C., almost 300 or over 300 plus years. And then the book of Ruth we date, and it's a difficult book to date, approximately 1250 B.C. So if we're looking at our wonderful maps here again, you see that if you think about where the nation of Israel, where the people were, they came from over here in Mesopotamia, then a lot of the Genesis stuff happens here. then eventually Jacob and Joseph and all these guys end up in Egypt. Now think about that. So much of Genesis is played out in Israel. We know to be Canaan or Israel at that time. Then Exodus, most of that's played out in Egypt. And then here in the Sinai, Egypt and the Sinai. That's where Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, right here. So when you're thinking about it, geographically, this is where all this happens. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, all of that right there. So the nation of Israel, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and then they end up back here in Deuteronomy, right? Right in the plains. Plains of Moab, not very far from where Ammon is. And that's where they end up. So I want you, when you're thinking about those books of the Bible, think about your geography, too, of where they happen in the context of it. So today, what's going to happen, so I also want to remind you about the borders today, right? So this is Israel. What's this little thing right here inside of the West Bank? What's this? That's the Gaza Strip. This is Jordan. There's Issa and Abby right over here, right? Okay, this is the Sinai. Here's Saudi Arabia, where we said the Medians were. And here is Egypt. Now, what happened in Egypt today? The Muslim Brotherhood took over. Did you hear what the first thing that the new president said about the new capital for Egypt, where it would be located? He said, Allah willing, the new capital would be in Jerusalem. Right on television this morning. So I want you to remember the dates on the timeline and the books that go with them, okay, and then where they are on maps. Everybody with me on that? Okay. All right. Let's take a little journey across the river. There you go. Here's a good relief map. You can see our places again. I want to just burn these into your head as we look through them. So let's go back a second. Come on. There we go. So what's this body of water? Dead Sea, the lowest place on earth, right? Okay, and then you're going to find out that Jericho is the only inhabited city or the inhabited city with the lowest level below sea level. I mean, it is down there if you've been there. I've been to Jericho. It is dry and it is down. So we know where Jericho is. Here is the Jordan River. What's this body of water right here? The Sea of Galilee. Okay, and our friends are here. This is where they are. So you can see where Mount Nebo is. We're gonna cross right over here towards Jericho. Okay? Just more maps. I just want to, again, burn this into your head until you have this as second nature. So Ammon is over here. Here's Mount Nebo. Who dies on Mount Nebo? Moses does. And we're going to cross right over into Jericho. So, who recognizes that piece of work? Here are a couple paintings. They're from the Hermitage. The Hermitage is a museum in what city? St. Petersburg. Good. And this is Raphael, the Renaissance painter. And what do you think that's a painting of? It's a little tough to see, but here's the Ark. Here's the Jordan River. This is Raphael's version of the crossing. Here's where Joshua and the nation of Israel. He actually painted an entire series on this. Very interesting. This is again Raphael at the Hermitage. And what do you think that's a picture of? The walls of Jericho coming down. So let's leave a nice picture. There's Jericho today. And it is a West Bank city, just so you know. It's Palestinian occupied. If you look at your outline, you can see that Yahushua, right, means Yahweh saves or Yahweh delivers. That's what Joshua means. If your name is Josh, that's a great name to have. The main theme of Joshua is Israel's conquest and possession of Canaan through faith in Yahweh. We know that over 600,000 fighting men and approximately 2.5 million Israelites crossed the Jordan and entered into the promised land. Close your eyes and think about that for a moment. Think about the immense size of the nation of Israel. Think about how important unity is among these people. Think about how they grew as a people in Egypt, so much so that the Pharaoh was worried about them. And this group just keeps going. And this is after the punishment and death of all the first generation of the Exodus group. 2.5 million. Do you think that some of the people that were on the other side of the Jordan perhaps were noticing that some folks were coming across the river? Think about that for a second. For those of you that are Canaanite lovers, this was a really, really tough thing. The tribes, there were a couple tribes that don't cross. And if you were at the Focal Point Classic, how many people golfed at the Focal Point Classic? Wasn't that one of the questions and one of the holes, right? Hope you guys got it. The tribes of Reuben and the tribes of Gad don't cross, and they take their property allowance on the other side of the Jordan River, and half of Manasseh also. So technically three or two and a half of the tribes don't go with Joshua. The events covered in the book of Joshua, I told you, occur over an 11-year period from just after Moses' death to the death of Joshua. Although two and a half tribes have settled east of the Jordan, they're still sending 40,000 fighting men to accompany the rest of Israel in the conquest. There's a definite spirit of anticipation and unity as the entire population, 2.5 million of them, move into their promised land. And that promised land is Canaan. And the name Canaan, we think, comes from the son of Ham. The son of Ham. His name is Canaan. Now, I gave you a simple, simple outline of the book of Joshua. I put it into two Roman numerals and then broke each Roman numeral down for you. Israel's conquest of the land, that's the fill in his conquest, is chapters 1 through 12. You see them entering into Cana. There's a central campaign, a southern campaign, a northern campaign, and then a summary of all their campaigns. Because remember, they cross the Jordan, and they take Jericho, which is a great city to take right there, good base for them to work off of. And then they continue going north, south, and to the west, and they want to conquer all the land, and they want to kill all the Canaanites or drive the Canaanites totally out of the land. The second Roman numeral is Israel's distribution. So conquest and then distribution of the land, and that distribution covers chapters 13 through 24. Obviously, the allocations to the tribes, the allocations to the cities of refuge, allocations to the Levitical cities. There was a controversy between the east and west tribes. And then final events of Joshua's life culminate what we're talking about. Now, key verses inside the book of Joshua, there are a couple of them that I want to call your attention to. If you have your Bibles, open them quickly to Joshua chapter number 1. Joshua chapter number 1. And here's the beginning of the conquest. Joshua chapter 1. And let me read this to you. Verse 6, be strong and courageous, for you shall cause the people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Don't turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. Why? So that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Verse 9, have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Don't be frightened and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Now, I mean, that's a Sunday school passage, right? I mean, it's such an amazing passage. But if you mine through it and you look through that carefully, you find that this large group of people who have a history of the Exodus and of bad parents and have come to this pinnacle moment to cross over, and their leader, their one big leader, Joshua, is being told to be strong and courageous. And one of the most important things in verse 8, he says, this book of the law, it should never depart from your mouth, but you meditate on it day and night so you know that you're being obedient. And how important is that in our Christian life? I mean, that's what we're talking about with a DBR, daily Bible reading. And a lot of people are like, you're Bible, at Compass Bible Church. And yes, that's exactly what we're about. We're about Bible. Great passages like this one here in Joshua say that these people need to meditate on the Word of God. They need to know what God wants them to do. And it's exactly what Joshua is commanded by God to do. At the end of his life, in Joshua 24, verse number 15, if you could turn there very quickly, Joshua 24, 15, it's a culmination. It's the end of Joshua's life. It's that moment of like, what are you doing? And the challenge to the people that are left, the challenge to his kids, the challenge to the nation of Israel. Look at Joshua 24, 15. And he basically says, and if it's evil in your eyes to serve Yahweh, then you need to make a choice today. You need to step up to the stage. You need to choose this day whom you will serve. Is it going to be the gods your father served in the region beyond this river? Or is it going to be the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living? And the conclusion that Joshua comes to in this big question is this conclusion. But as for me and my house, we're going to serve Yahweh. We're not going to be about the gods of the Amorites. We're not going to be about Ashtoreth. We're not going to be about Baal. We're not going to be about El. We're going to be about Yahweh and Yahweh alone. For as for me and my house, we will certainly serve Yahweh. What a powerful, powerful culmination to the book of Joshua. Looking back at our outline just very quickly, I want to show you pictures of obedience and pictures of disobedience that are found in the book of Joshua. The ultimate sign of obedience is pictured in Jericho, represents a picture of obedience as the people had faith in what? An unorthodox way of fashioning victory. Remember? What did God tell them to do when they got to the walls of Jericho? Yes, walk around it, man. So you got all these fighting guys, and they're all like, and they're trudging around the wall. That's unorthodox. I know they're not teaching that at West Point today. They're not. But as miraculous as the parting of the Red Sea was, so was the parting of the Jordan River. So was this miraculous sign to the people of Israel. This was a sign of the power of Yahweh and the fact that God didn't need any of those warriors to get accomplished what he needed to get accomplished. As a result of it, the Israelites were compelled to follow God's instruction, at least for a while. On the other side of it was a guy named Achan. Remember Achan's sin? Achan represents an example of disobedience. Remember Achan? He was the guy, he was a fighter. He was the guy that walked around the wall with everyone else. He saw everything. And remember what Yahweh told him is like, hey, don't take any silver, don't take any gold, don't take any of the stuff. And what happens is he takes a bunch of stuff, puts it in his tent, and the Israelites think that they can go into this next community, Ai, and go up there and have victory. And the Israelites go, and they get their butt kicked horribly. 36 men lose their lives that day. And the people realize through God's providential communication to them that there's sin in the camp. There's sin in the camp, and it's Achan. And it's interesting that God gave everybody an opportunity to come clean in the morning. And Achan had an opportunity to walk up and go, I'm the guy. And he doesn't. And he's found out. And as a result of that, he is punished. And his family is punished. Capital punishment. All the way around. Achan represents an example of disobedience. And God's punishment represents both an example and a warning to the other Israelites. An example in the sense of what happened to Achan's family. And God killed Achan's family along with Achan. A warning in the sense that, hey, if there's sin in the camp, guys, and you think you're going to go represent me, and you think there's going to be a battle to be won, don't do it, because you're not going to prosper. Go back to Deuteronomy. I told you, if you're in sin, you will not win. And that's exactly what happens here. The religions of Canaan are really important to really understand the rest of the Old Testament. You got to be with me here in this next paragraph. But before we do the next paragraph, let's see if I've got any other pictures of Jericho. Oh, these are great pictures of Jericho. So Jericho is not a fun city. When you go on the Israel trip, we don't take you to Jericho. Not really necessarily a fun place to go to, unless you're an archaeologist. And we've got, if you are, we've got plenty of great sites that you can go work and do digs. But just hanging around the scene there, really not a whole lot to see. And most of the people are some of them are angry Palestinians. They don't necessarily like you and I or the people in Israel. This is hot. It's hot all the time. It's just hot. Yeah, I mean, this time of year, when our gang goes to Israel, they'll go swimming right about here at this red dot. This time of year, dry heat, not a humid heat. That's good. Yeah. People say that all the time. Oh, it's a dry heat. It's a dry cold. It's still cold. It's still hot. Probably about 100 degrees at least.
Oh, okay.
At least 100. If you go in May or if you go in like October, other times I've gone, maybe 80 or 90 degrees. It's still going to be very hot. So not bad. So this is on the in the West Bank, looking down. Here's the city of Jericho. Jordan River runs this way. This is the Dead Sea right here. Now just flipping around, looking from the other angles, looking from the south to the north. You can see the city of Jericho right there. One of the oldest cities that we have in the world. Atel, remember we talked about Atel, is generation after generation, just building on a hill. Probably think as many as 32 different civilizations that we've been able to go through in the city of Jericho. So, some more pictures. And there's the Jordan River as it runs today, not very far from where we think that the nation of Israel crossed over. This is not in the spring. In the spring, the river is back up higher than that. But fording a river like this in this area is pretty fast, swift, and it's pretty deep. And so they did benefit from a little bit of the parting to get them to the other side. Here were the 12 tribes of Israel. Here's, again, what's this? Dead Sea. What's this? And this river? Jordan. And the Jordan goes in the upper Jordan up that way. Here are the tribes that don't go across: Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. Okay, and that's the way the property gets distributed. So, could you see that from over there that way? Okay, so I don't have to do it a second time. Okay, so we'll leave the judges' stuff up there. So let's talk a little bit about foreign gods. So a couple of gods you've got to understand the Old Testament and who they are and what they represent to people. So the religions of the Canaanites represented, first of all, the basest form of idolatry. El was the supreme god, and El was pictured as an old man or a father figure. Now, El, as a supreme god, also had children. And his son, his number one son, was Baal, B-A-A-L. If you're going to be with me, and we'll do a little bit of Hebrew, You can always call it Baal. That's the way you say it, not Baal. People talk about Baal worship, Baal worship. Baal is B-A-L-E or B-A-I-L, not B-A-A-L. Baal, that's the way you say that. And so Baal is the son of El, and he represents the epitome of virility and of youthfulness. He becomes the god of rain, the god of mountains, the god of storms, and the god of vegetation. Now he had a consort, and his consort was Ashtaroth. Ashtaroth is the goddess of sex and the goddess of fertility, Ashtaroth. You're going to hear Baal, Ashtaroth, and a third god called Molech. And those are the gods that we're going to have to know a little bit about. The Canaanites worshiped these gods through rites, which included immoral actions, and the life of these people was characterized, the Canaanite people, was characterized through immorality. So, immorality. So, did someone typo that? Someone shouldn't be typing at 1 o'clock in the morning, I can tell. It's immorality, not immortality. So let's think this through a little bit. Can you think about places in the Old Testament where the worship of Baal or Baal becomes important? Do you see it anywhere else? Like Elisha, remember Elijah? And he takes on the prophets of Baal. Ashtaroth, the female consort of Baal, the hope of the people is that they would procreate together. And every single guy in town would come to the temple prostitutes. So if you were a married man and these people were agrarian, they were farmers, they believed that if the god of rain and vegetation and that told them to come up to the temple and to have sex with the temple prostitutes, believe me, the wives of those husbands said, go do that. In our Western culture for a moment, can you imagine ladies sending your husbands out and being okay with that, to going to the temple to meet temple prostitutes with the idea that that god, the god you believed in, if there was an appeasement through the sex and the immorality, that what would happen is that your crops would grow bigger, that there would be higher levels of prosperity. That's what the Canaanites believed, and that's what they did. Not dissimilar, by the way, to later on in New Testament theology. If you go to the city of Ephesus and you look at some of the Greek and Roman gods, a goddess called Diana or Artemis that Paul encounters in Ephesus, the men believe the same thing, and the women push their men to the temple to Diana or Artemis to do the same things in the name of prosperity. That's what the Canaanites were about. That was what their god was about. Yahweh, you know a lot about what Yahweh is about because you've been through Torah. You've been through the book of Leviticus. You know that Yahweh is not about this. Matter of fact, he condemns sexual immorality and says this is wrong and sinful. And this new group of people, the Canaanites, now are on the other side of the Jordan, and here come the Israelites to hang out with them together. So Baal, El, Ashtaroth. Do you remember the Ashtaroth poles that you'll find? We'll find these later on in the book of Kings. And then there's a third god I didn't talk about, and that's the god Molech. Molech, M-O-L-E-C-H. And the god of Molech is the god of infanticide. That's the god that said, bring me your firstborn. For those of you that have been with me to Israel, or if you are going to go to Israel, if you go to Megiddo, the ancient city there, they have an amazing, amazing altar to Molech that is still built there. And the deal was, as a parent, you would bring your infant and sacrifice your infant in the name of fertility, in the names of all the other things in prosperity we've talked about. And the temple of Molech, they had priests that sat with drums, and they'd bang the drums really hard, and they would bang them hard to drown out the sound of the babies that were screaming to their death as they were incinerated on these altars. These were the things, Molech and Baal and Ashtaroth, that become the competitor to Yahweh, the God of Israel. It's going to be that way for the rest of the Old Testament. And you have to get that in your mind and into your Western culture mind, because you think it's so outrageous here in our Western culture. This was not that outrageous to a bunch of agrarian people that dwelt on this land, maybe 3,500 years ago. Let's take a quick look at the book of Judges. Shopatim. That's a good Hebrew word. The theme of Israel's apostasy, oppression, and deliverance during the rule of the judges. Now, what happens is after Joshua's death, Israel fell into a state of disorganization because they didn't have a national leader. Joshua's dead. They had some elders that kind of hung around. They had a different thing, but there was no national leader. The key verse of the entire book is printed a couple times, is this one. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And that's in Judges 17:6 and Judges 21:25. And it describes the political and moral disarray of God's people in the land. Without a unifying head for the theocracy, tribal distinctions become much more pronounced, and a national unity is almost now non-existent. So now, if you're in the tribe of Reuben or Dan, and everyone's like, hey, we're all on the Israel team, who's the coach? We don't really have it. So what they're slinking back into is into their own tribes and saying, yay, Dan, yay, Reuben. And they're finding unity in these smaller tribes as opposed to being unified under one major leader of the national Israel. Now, in spite of the covenant with Yahweh, the Israelites become involved in the idolatry and the immorality of the Canaanites, whom they had not completely driven from the land. Do you see that becomes the problem in the book of Judges? All the gods that are sitting waiting right there on the other side, Molech and Baal and Ashtaroth, are competitors to Yahweh. And what happens is some of the people of Israel start saying, I like those gods better. And they start being involved in immorality and idolatry. Thus, religious and political disunity in the nation, it leads to internal problems of idolatry and immorality, as you can imagine. The Israelites were plagued with external problems as well. You see, God isn't going to sit down. He's not going to let these people disobey like that. And some of their big, big problems were in the form of oppressors. Oppressors. Those were other small, regionalized nations that were fighting and oppressing the Israelites. Egypt had the main control of this area at this time. Egypt is a world power. Egypt was having their own problems. And so Egypt left their little nations over here where Israel was alone. And as a result of that, you have provincial power all over the place because the Egyptians are hands-off at this point. Now, these oppressors, I told you, were local surrounding nations rather than the major powers of the time. God in his grace raises judges. He raises a group of judges to rule in Israel and to give military deliverance. These judges, charismatic leaders who rallied Israel to the defeat of their enemies. The period of the judges represents a period of dark ages. If you know the stories of the judges, there's some really horrendous and disturbing things that the Israelites do in the book of Judges. And they're characterized by both spiritual and moral decline and disunity. We think the judges reigned in Israel for well over 300 years. Ehud, Gideon, Deborah, Samson, and then Samson was the third to the last judge. Eli is the second to the last judge. And the last judge is Samuel. Samuel becomes it. And these people represent some of the more recognizable judges that you might know. A major theme and pattern is found in the book of Judges. And I want you to clearly understand this. Because if you can get this theme I'm ready to give you right now, you'll be able to get through the entire book of Judges, and you'll see the repeatable pattern that that happens. As the author records Israel's history under various oppressors and judges, he traces the logical progression of Israel's relapse. That's the first thing. Relapse into sin. So first thing they do is they relapse into sin. Then the second thing, I try to keep it all ours, is they go into ruin through the oppression of their enemies. Then they cry out to God in repentance. And God gives them restoration. That restoration comes through a judge, okay? And then there's a time of rest, a time of peace. Turn to Judges 3, verses 7 through 11, and I'll illustrate just one quick pattern of it. But once you see this pattern once, you could read the book of Judges this afternoon and look for that pattern. You'll see it a zillion times in this book. Look at Judges chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God. They served Asherah and they served Baal. See it right there? There's our two pagan gods. They have relapsed into sin. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. He sold them into the hand of the Cushan-Rishathaim, the king of Mesopotamia. And the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim for 8 years. They're in ruin. But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, repentance, right? The Lord raised up a deliverer for the people of Israel who saved them, Othniel. He's a judge. He raised a judge up, and when they screamed for repentance, folks, and the Spirit of the Lord was upon him, he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, the king of Mesopotamia, into his hands, and the hand in his hand prevailed over him, so that the land, what? Rested for 40 years. Then Othniel went and died, and he ruined it all. And guess what happens to Israel? They relapse into sin, and it goes back around again and again. If you can keep that pattern in your mind through the book of Judges will mean something totally different to you. You'll be able to see exactly what happens to these people over and over and over again. Now, there were a couple major failures in Joshua's generation. It's the last couple of sentences in our outline. The two major failures of Joshua's generation were their inability to drive the Canaanites from the land. There's problem number one. And instead of driving the Canaanites out, they did just the opposite. They intermarried with the Canaanites, and they ended up embracing their gods. So when God says, hey, wipe out this group of people or push these people out, in our 21st century softness, we'll look at that and go, oh, God's pretty mean about that. That's genocide. That's horrible. God had a plan, and he wanted the nation of Israel to drive these people with Molech and Ashtoreth and Baal out of the land. And they didn't complete the job. Joshua's group did not complete the job. The second big problem that encountered them was their failure to pass their faith along to their children. Turn quickly with me to Judges chapter 2, verse number 7 through 17. I'm going to read this quickly while you're turning there, because I don't think anybody in this room would want this prophecy for their children. Verse number 7, Judges chapter 2, and the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. It makes it real clear here in the book of Judges, written probably by Samuel, by the way. He's saying, look, they saw it. They saw everything that was great. They saw every bit of it. They saw every miracle. And Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, dies at the age of 110. They bury him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim. That's where he was from, the northern mountains of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. So Joshua's generation is just done. Next generation. And there rose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. What happened? In Deuteronomy, they were told, whether they were sitting, whether they were standing, whether they were walking, to impress God's word, the Torah, on the hearts of their kids. And here the great Joshua apparently missed that. Verse 11, and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. And who did they serve? They served the Baals. They were given over to the Canaanites. And they abandoned Yahweh, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they went after other gods. And that was from among the gods of the people who were around them, the Canaanites. They bowed down to him. And guess what? Yahweh took notice, and it provoked him to great anger. They abandoned the Lord. They served Baal. They served Ashtaroth. And so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to their plunderers who plundered them. And he stole them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever those kids marched out, the hand of the Yahweh was against them for harm. Parents today, would you want that for your kids? I don't want that for my kids. But Joshua's generation not only failed in the full conquest, but they failed in one of the most important areas that God had instructed them, and that was training and discipling their own kids. And the result for this generation was horrible. It was horrible. The very last verse of the entire book of Judges sets us up for next week. Judges 21:25. And in those days, there was no king in Israel. Israel had no king. And as a result of that, when there's no police officer standing in front of the light, in front of over here, if there's no CHP officer on the 5 freeway today, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. What a sad epitaph to the time of Judges. And when we get into 1 and 2 Samuel, you'll see that Israel, in the time of Samuel, the last judge, they're gonna end it, because the nation of Israel is going to say, we want a, what do they want? They're going to want a king. We're going to want a king. Quickly, let's see where Ruth fits into all of this, and we'll be done. Oh, by the way, that is a statue of Baal. Evil-looking guy. Let's take a look at Ruth. Ruth's name actually translated means compassion. Compassion. The theme of Ruth is God's blessing upon the loyal love of Ruth through her kinsman redeemer, Boaz. Ruth was the great-grandmother of who? Of King David. Ruth is not an Israelite. Isn't that interesting? And she's in the line of David. Matter of fact, there are women that are mentioned in a genealogy in Matthew chapter 1 that mostly are not Israelites. And when was the last time, and I know a little bit about Jewish ancient genealogies, that women are mentioned in genealogies. And yet this girl right here, Ruth, is smack dab right in the middle of that genealogy. Prove it to you, Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, see it later. You'll see Ruth's name right there. Part of the line of Jesus Christ is this woman. The first verse of the book clearly identifies the time period as the moral chaos of the judges, and sharply contrasted by the spirituality and fidelity of both Ruth, Boaz. You can throw Naomi in that as well. So here's Ruth in the time of Judges, about 1250, and all this moral chaos is going on, okay? All this bad stuff that the Israelites are involved in. But yet in the face of all that bad stuff that's going on in Judges, there's a remnant. of people that are holy and righteous and doing what they ought to be doing, represented in the Bible by Ruth and by Boaz and by Naomi. The book thus shows another side of the personal life of this period, confirming that some individuals did maintain fear and obedience to Yahweh, even though the nation as a whole fell into apostasy. This is a huge, huge theme that you've got to get. Think about it as we're going through. Joshua, good guy, right? Comes into the land with the Israelites. They cross the Jordan together. A lot of those guys get involved with the Canaanites, and there's sin, and there's a whole bunch of problems that they're having, and it looks like Israel's going down. The book of Judges is all about that, about the apostasy. But in the face of it, God gives us a story about two women, Ruth and Naomi. And Ruth and Naomi, and Ruth is a picture, a beautiful picture of God's grace and compassion. And she loves her mother-in-law so much that she's willing to give up her life in Moab, if you know the whole story. And she goes, Naomi, where you go, I go. I'll come with you. And it's a beautiful picture. Naomi's a beautiful picture as she brings Ruth to Boaz, part of her family. And Boaz, who's a kinsman redeemer, is a guy who's in the family, and he knows that Ruth lost her husband, and he steps to the stage, and he marries Ruth. And not only does he marry her, but he redeems her from her poverty. It's a beautiful love story that's built right in here at the back end of the book of Judges to provide you and to provide me hope that even in the worst times of moral decay, where it seems like every Christian in the world is sinful and doing the wrong things, and it's really frustrating, that God always has a remnant of people just like Ruth and just like Naomi and just like Boaz. I put something in here for you I think is interesting. It's an outline of the book of Ruth. And Ruth's a story. And in Act 1, you see a prologue, and there's a problem that comes up. Naomi's husband dies. Ruth's husband dies. Her brother-in-law dies. And this is a big problem. There's a lot of gloom. And then you'll see stories in the Bible. You can do this also in the Gospels. There'll be a story. There'll be a problem after the setting is put out. They'll have characters that are introduced. And then there's a problem, and you'll sit there and go, oh, how's Ruth going to get out of this? How's Naomi going to, they don't have any men, and men are really important in the ancient Near East. How's that going to happen? And then options start coming into play, and God starts coming into play. And then at the very end, just like any other good play, there's a conclusion. And we see the conclusion. It provides us with an opportunity to think through, wow, here's a Judean family from Bethlehem that is restored. So lastly, if you look at this last paragraph, by the way, that painting right there is a picture of Boaz and Ruth. And that's one of my favorite artists, Rembrandt, who painted that. And he is sitting there pouring out food and blessings for his wife-to-be. So the contributions of the book of Ruth are a couple. The first thing is the book of Ruth provides evidence of a godly remnant even during Israel's darkest days of apostasy. I don't know about you, but in my Christian life, I need Christian heroes. I need men and women in this world and in this generation I can look to and go, wow, you know what this whole thing looks like? It's horrible and awful, but this person, man, they're living for Christ, and I can see their example, and I can see their witness. It's so encouraging to me. I don't know about you, but it's so encouraging to see men and women living for Christ. And what an encouragement in the Bible, in the worst time, and one of the worst times in biblical history, the time of the judges, that there was a Ruth, that there was a Naomi, there was a Boaz. Secondly, it provides the genealogy of David and the Messiah, showing God's faithfulness to the covenant. He's going to be faithful to a Davidic covenant, and he's going to be faithful to an Abrahamic covenant. And we've got to be excited about that because Ruth is in that line. So in the face of all this moral corruption, the line of Christ continues along. And Ruth is a part of that as the great-grandmother to King David. Thirdly, Boaz represents, in typology, a type of Christ. He's a guy who is a kinsman redeemer. He's the guy that's coming in, and here's Ruth. She can't save herself, and he comes in, and he's a picture of salvation as he saves this woman. And he does it as a human being, just as Jesus was 100% human and 100% God. And I'm not saying that Boaz was God. I'm saying he's a picture or a type of Christ in this story. Fourthly, Ruth is an example of how godly women and godly Gentiles are also instruments in God's plan. Don't let that escape your attention. The Old Testament is Jewish. Jesus is Jewish. Paul was Jewish. John was Jewish. Most all the disciples were Jewish. It's all Jewish. But yet, in this Jewish Old Testament, God is making it really clear that he's not only using men, but he's using women, and women that aren't Jews, to get his plan brought forward. And how encouraging is it that God has that? So here's all my pictures of Bethlehem real quickly. That's where the Book of Ruth takes place. Told you about the big security fence there. There's a nice picture of a shepherd with some sheep. So we are at 10:38. I saw Pastor Bobby multiple times come walking in, and he's really nervous because he starts like in 20 minutes. But you know what? He's got these really young guys. They can break these tables down like this, set it up, no problem. So perhaps we should sit and talk for another 15 or 20 minutes and really put them to the test.